Blog Talk Radio.
Terminal fans, welcome to the show. Sun Guy, Randy Zellers, and QT Volks with you as normal. And today we are celebrating Media Day. We have a long, long history of media as it relates to pro wrestling, be it in magazines, be it in newsletters, be it in podcasts like we are doing right now, be it and your local news anchors and sportscasters discussing the local matches. There's always been a link between wrestling and media. And with us some people that have been in the pro wrestling media. We have with us former Pro Wrestling Illustrated writer and noted author, Gary Morgenstein. Welcome.
Hey, nice to be on. Thank you for having me.
And we also have with us from Pro Wrestling Torch, Bruce Mitchell. Thank you for being on today.
Good to be here.
Well, my first question for both of you is, what led you to decide that you wanted to work in the media that covered professional wrestling? And I guess we'll start with Gary.
I needed a job, which I think is always the great driving philosophical artistic motivation between why a lot of people end up where they end up. I've been a journalist for the Cincinnati Post. I moved back to New York, and I answered an ad in Newsday, and I had the interview. This was with now we're going back to 1978, so we're going to go back on a memory lane. This was with GC London Publishing, which later became known as the Aptamax, and I took a writing test. And I've always been sort of a wrestling fan. As a kid, I watched it a lot, and I loved Bruno Sammartino. I always thought it was fun. I was a sports fan. So I took the writing test, and it was about Fritz Van Erich. And all I remember is that, first of all, Peter King, the editor-in-chief, said it was okay. And then he said, but you're not allowed to put the ages of the wrestlers in the stories. I said, okay. And so, back in those days, now this was Inside Wrestling, The Wrestler, and later, as you mentioned, PWI, there was no one else but us for the most part. I think maybe Dave Meltzer, maybe he had his newsletter then. There was some, I don't want to diss anyone, but for the most part, there were no other magazines of any note, really. There certainly wasn't cable TV. There wasn't podcasts like you guys have. It was a different world, and so we were really it. And on newsstand sales would beat Sports Illustrated. So there was an appetite back in the day.
And Bruce Mitchell, what about you? How did you get into the working in the media of pro wrestling game?
You know, it's really a different route than Gary, but it goes back, as Gary said, to 1978. I was coming out of high school, and I just got fascinated with pro wrestling. And I read the wrestling magazines. I would go, and I can remember the first time, getting a bloody cover and walking up to the clerk and of inside wrestling, and
yeah,
kind of feeling like, I'd already worked out how to buy a Playboy and a penthouse, but I still feel kind of weird doing that. But I got, and it was the only place I knew to get information. And I didn't have any friends that were wrestling fans, and I figured out what day and what day of the week that the wrestling magazines would come, and Pro Wrestling Illustrated first, but Inside Wrestling and The Wrestler, and I bet I did that for 4 or 5 years. And then at the university I was at, I would figure out I was in Greensboro, I'm in the Southeast, so I figured out which newspapers would have results. And I would go into the bins and at the university library and go find results and of usually current shows. I remember I found out that Ric Flair won the NWA title from the Asheville newspaper because I was looking in it and looking for. I thought there was a Sunday show, and it was 4 or 5 days later, and I found the clip for it, and it was about 5 sentences long, and all it said was that Ron Bass had replaced Ric Flair in the show in Asheville on Sunday night because Ric Flair had won the NWA title in Kansas City. And I was like, wow. But I had no one to tell it to. And I went like that for a few years. Then I finally met some friends to share information with and to talk to and to go to and to go to shows with. I would go to shows by myself most of the time. I got a cool connection to going to Greensboro Coliseum, front row seats and all that. And then I never, through wrestling magazines, I never sent things out in the mail. I still don't like doing it. And I sent $5 to the Wrestling Observer. I was a longtime Sports Illustrated reader, too. And I recognized, the Hulk Hogan issue. Dave Meltzer was featured in the Hulk Hogan issue, and I sent $5 to the Wrestling Observer. And I always saw myself as a writer, but I wasn't writing very much. And I sent letters to the Observer just to kind of do something. And it was when the Wrestling Observer had a really, really cool fan base that wrote letters. I mean, there was no internet, there was no nothing. And so people reacted to it. And then about 1990, I started working for Wade Keller, and I sent him a column unbidden, and he ran it. And then later on, and a month or two later, he said, "Do you want to write for me?" And I wrote longer columns and more in depth stuff, I definitely looked back at all those magazines. And to me, the magazines were more. I knew what wrestling was, but I wasn't sure how it worked, and learned how to take information and figure out, okay, is this valid? Is this not valid? But the place I would find is 6 weeks later. They would have Bill Apter would have his What's Happening columns, and I'd figure out where people went and all that kind of stuff. And it just built and built. And I was in on the early days of the Torch and all the different medias and the 900 numbers and the weekly newsletters and everything, podcast and radio. I did AM radio for years around here and FM radio because no one had any wrestling information. And so if you went on a sports show with wrestling information, and there was as Gary said, there was a demand for it, and boy, they liked it, and people wanted to hear. So all the technologies have changed and all that, but you still and the business has changed so much, but still an interesting business. And I tried to always try to write what I think is true and all that, a different kind of from the kayfabe into the covering as a journalist thing, but I always wanted to be a writer, so that part has been really gratifying and important to me to write about something so interesting and then have such a volatile fan base to write for. It's been really cool.
Oh, yeah, and they would hold us. They'd hold us our feet to the fire if we ever got anything wrong.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah, I mean, one of my jobs was answering all those fan letters and then writing responses, and it was wonderful because I think Bruce and I and the people we worked with, we respected the fans. Now you go back in the day, most people belittled wrestling. They thought it was a joke.
Right.
It was fake. It was just a bunch of fat guys. I mean, they should only know the athletic skill it requires to be a professional wrestler, the strength and agility and the balance. It's a great deal of work, which never got really factored in. It was just, oh yeah, well, it's just that's not real. Although I found my friends would, I tell my friends, my job, and they say, yeah, it's fake. And they say, but there was that one match that was real. It was always, Bruce, didn't you find
right.
the psychology, right? They had to latch on to stuff.
Yeah.
That time, Bruno Sammartino really beat the hell out of, Pedro Morales or something, right?
Yeah. There were all kinds of theories. I mean, there was a theory that anything after intermission, I'd go to regular show, Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling and for Crockett Promotions, and that you'd hear fans may tell you that any of the matches after the intermission, those are real because those were the money matches. Or they would tell you that none of the matches were real except for the World Championship matches because that was too important.
Yeah.
That when Ric Flair came out, it was real. Or if someone with blonde hair, if there was blood, that meant it was real. And, the ability to get fans, and still it's really important to pull them into the action, pull them into the story, and pull them into the fight. And so you'd see the emotions come out, and there were times when you knew people really believed it was real. And I was watching in the late 70s and the early 80s when – and it still happens today very rarely. In fact, it doesn't happen now because of COVID. But, people get so excited, they jump into the ring and try to attack the wrestlers.
Sure.
I was like, oh, my God, are you nuts? But, no matter how. But, yeah, you had that emotion. And then they would leave. Then after the emotion would calm down, they would tell you, it's a show. If they could get there get fired up about it, it would be there. But I learned a lot from y'all's magazines, but I also learned so much from watching. I got hooked by a successful promotion, and that was Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. And I learned so much about, they want you to come. They want you to think that the next show is when the good guy is going to finally get justice on the bad guy. And then they would get you right to it. And then, not quite there. And then there would be one match where everybody knew, go to the show and there'd be a sellout because it was in a steel cage and the good guy was going to get Ricky Steamboat was going to beat Ric Flair and he wasn't going to get his head shaved.
You're using the language that you really can't use anymore, good and bad. Because it was good versus evil in a way. And so people's emotions could get worked up and you could have those extremes because it was a different kind of society that people would accept that. And now it's so much, it's such grace.
That's true.
Right. I mean, even though our society is polarized, we dare not go into the black and white of it all because God knows what we'd unleash.
Right. And then,
we were a little more civilized back then, at least with sports.
Yeah, and it was, although I think about, as far as civilization, it was such an outlaw thing. I mean, it was just like that visceral energy, and I can remember the first show or two I went to, and someone tossed a liquor bottle to the concrete Greensboro Coliseum floor, and I was like, oh my, it's like 1980 or so. It's like, that kind of thing. There were just so many, and there still is. I mean, but there were so many. People wanted to see their favorites win, and they wanted to see the people that they hated lose. It wasn't so much they wanted to be surprised or shocked, although that was good when it happened. They wanted to see something of consequence happen, but they wanted to see the good guy win.
Back then, it was clear. You knew who was good. And who is bad. It wasn't someone saying, no, the bad guys are really good. No. This is good and bad. And there was something very comforting to the fans. And as you say, it was right because there would be a surprise, a heartbreaking moment. A tag team match. I mean, how many tag team matches did we see with a betrayal? It was, at times it was very Shakespearean. And those of us in the wrestling media always respected the fans. We never, ridiculed them. We never ridiculed the sport. We always gave it the honor. I tell you, I dealt in my career with other athletes and certainly other in television, wrestlers are far and away the kindest, most respectful, most decent bunch of people to ever work with. I worked with them when I worked for Sci-Fi Channel, and I did the publicity, at least for the corporate point of view, for SmackDown. And, you know, everyone said, because no one on the staff wanted to work, they're all wrestling, oh, no, and they roll their eyes. He said, that's fine. I'm happy because these people are going to be easy to work with. They're not going to be some actress or actor with snark. You know, they know what they have to do. They understand the whole notion about a job and rewarding and being nice to your fans and being respectful. And it's a whole different – it's just a different mentality in this part of society. And I think – and it's not appreciated enough, I don't think, the special of the wrestling.
And part of being a pro wrestler was to take fans who didn't know you and bond them to you.
Yes.
You know, and or bond them against you. But you had so that was so communicating with fans and all the little techniques and all the little ways of working on television and in the ring. And I loved the promos. I was like, that was the thing. And I still think, like, back then, the promos, there were bad ones, but there were the guys that were really good were really, really good, and that was the fun of watching it. And I look back at those magazines and you know, your work and after, and I think of the late Dan Shockett, because I loved that kind of – I thought he was a good writer, like a very good wordsmith.
Very good writer.
And then kind of looking you know, turning things on its head. And I don't think he meant to, but I think that, you know, being the pro bad guy writer, he was ahead of his time as far as the where the business went and the business went.
Oh, he meant
that
to. Oh, trust me. Danny meant to be the pro bad guy.
I know he meant to, but I mean, I don't think he meant to change the entire business where the bad guy was, the bad guy was predominant. But but you had to have the bad guy. But
You need the bad guy. If we didn't have bad guys, there'd be nothing. You know, it's the yin and the yang, right? It's the universe.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, it's the two sides of the same coin, and then I remember even reading the magazines, going, I remember cracking up at Matt Brock because I was a reader growing up, and I'd read Raymond Chandler, and I'd read, I knew about sports writers and all that, so I loved like that kind of, hard bitten old time drinking sports writer. in the bar, hanging out with either the bad guys or hanging out with the Crusher and trying to avoid the bar fight. So I like that kind of character stuff too. But it's just a really you talked about how people look down on it, and they did, but it was also like this society, this culture where the people who didn't look down on it loved it. And you would, and on regular shows, you would go to shows and see, I'd go to work and do what I was doing. And then I would go to this other world with these other friends and these other culture that you would see. And it had gossip and it had had everything. Yeah. And it was like this, you found this great secret, this kind of rock and roll energy that a lot of people just dismissed because fake, but they were, they were wrong. And then, a lot of sports promoting and a lot of entertainment promoting, wrestling was ahead of the game as far as where it went and how successful it was.
Now, guys, I believe my co-host Randy Zellers might have a question. So, Randy, if you do, go ahead.
All righty. Hey, well, thank you guys for coming out and supporting Turnbuckle Turmoil. But I do got a question. What was the best part about being in your trade?
That people read what we wrote.
Oh, yeah.
And they trusted us and they needed us. Because, going back to, again, the fact there's no cable television, there's no internet.
You're right.
I mean, how would anyone in New York know what happened, you know, what Harley Race did, right? Or Ric Flair did. I mean, as Brian said, we were the conduits. And we, so with this, since there were so few of us, we had special, I mean, and we're talking not just in the United States, we're talking, you know, it was big in Europe, certainly Japan. So it was really critical that we had a real sense of responsibility. And there was a pride in that. And there's a pride that people like Brian would turn to us every month for his news, which he could, you know, not get, you know, again, except for, say, a Dave Meltzer, but he was not going to get it in the detail and in the comprehension that we would provide.
Well, that's deep. I respect that answer. I respect that. How about you? Same question.
I cut my teeth on reading what Gary and the Aftermath magazines, the Stanley London magazines all came up with and learned bit by bit. And then, as I said, like, I didn't have any friends for, I bet, 4 or 5 years that were wrestling fans. And then I found things, you know, and bit by bit, but I'm kind of a different generation. And I'm a Dave Meltzer guy in certain ways. I work for Wade Keller, but I'm a Dave Meltzer guy in certain ways. And I very much agree with Gary, like, writing for an audience that reacted, that would tell me, you did a great job, or they get pissed off, or they get what, you know, or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
really cool. And then if they got pissed off for reasons that I thought were, I didn't like it if they got pissed off because I got something wrong. I didn't want to get anything wrong, and I didn't want to, like, you know, but I wanted to, you know, if there was something that was a serious issue, I wanted to cover it. I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about the politics of wrestling, and I wanted to write about the, you know, for example, the steroid scandal, and really go in deep and get it. And
sure,
that, I felt like a lot of times that, and I still do, that there are times when we speak truth to power, or we speak up for people in the business that are suffering, or that they, you know, that their careers are suffering, or their health is suffering, and and over the years, with some of the bigger stories, Chris Benoit murder and suicide,
yeah,
that there was a place for the mainstream media to come, where we were serious about wrestling and serious about what was going on, and tried to tell the truth first. And they could be like a clearinghouse for them, and that was good. But I think there's little things and bigger things that you know, be an advocate and try and do some good, but also just get it right, whether wrestling, tell the truth as best as you could. And I'd use humor, I'd use sarcasm, I'd use, you know, straightforward stuff. But there's been times that, you know, I faced the heat, and I was fine with facing the heat if I thought it was worth doing. But if it was something really volatile, you had to get the story 100%. You couldn't get it 95%. You couldn't get it 99% and give that one excuse. But you said that show took place in Vermont, and it really took place in New England, and you're like, you know, like, it was that kind of thing. So I've enjoyed it, and then just learning, being a student of the history of wrestling and learning the history, and then seeing some, you know, being around some incredible stuff. I mean, that's been and meeting some really interesting people, you know, good and bad. So that's been cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember Mil Mascaris came to the office once, and we were going out to eat and for lunch, and he insisted on wearing his mask.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
dang.
You know, Mill, you know, it's going to look a little strange. Said, no, I'm wearing my mask. I'll be recognized. We said, wait a minute. How would you be recognized if you always wear your mask? So, you know, this is back in the day. We had this, like, burly guy sitting there with his mask. And, of course, some people stared. And then other people would come, oh, it's Mill Mascaris. And I,
Hey, well,
as long as he didn't have to stop by the bank, as long as he didn't take you into the bank, that's
there you
awesome.
Go. I don't know. With all these times now, you can actually get away with wearing your mask and your hood and going to the bank and actually withdraw some money.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, that's right.
I always love stories like that. I remember this was before I was riding, but Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair and the Carolinas was really getting big, and I had this family thing, and I was the only member of my family. I still am the only member of my family that was a wrestling fan, and my cousins came to eat, and my cousin's wife, who's nice, Anne's a nice lady, she's kind of she's kind of highfalutin or high society, and she was a buyer and was buying in New York and lived in Charlotte, and they were moving to another house, and so they had this opportunity to rent their house, and they go, well, you know, this wrestler wanted to rent our house, and so of course I, like, my ears perked up. I'm like, yeah, really? Well, what was his name? It was Billy Graham. And of course, I immediately went, oh, my God, Superstar Billy Graham. And it was Superstar Billy Graham. She had no idea about it. And she said that she was in New York for her business, and she was telling some friend in an elevator about this. And she goes, and everybody got really quiet when I said Superstar Billy Graham. I don't know who that was, but no one said anything. And I'm like, well, that's because, like, 4 or 5 years before this guy that wants to rent your house was selling out Madison Square Garden, where Muhammad Ali fought and the Rolling Stones played, and, you know, and Frank Sinatra sang, and every month he was the headliner, and there were 20,000 people. I was just kind of laughing to myself, because, you know, there was that thing of people didn't know, but the people who did know, and particularly, you know, in New York or something, you know, when he was at the height of his color, you know, the WWF champion and popularity and infamy. I mean, that was, and I just remember, like, well, I'm worried that they're going to tear our house up. And I'm like, they're not, you know, I don't think they're going to, like, they got to live somewhere too.
Weren't they going to do breaking chairs over people's heads? I mean, come on.
Yeah. I mean, it was completely that, you know, just a very intelligent lady, but it was completely that, those stereotypes. And I was just like, look, you know, Andy Warhol went to see Superstar Billy Graham, you know, and Deborah Harry and all these, you know, famous people. And it wasn't because it was the cool place to be. It was because it really was the cool place to be. It was something to discover.
Well, guys, I know that both of you had other things you needed to do today, so I will wrap up so we can let you guys get to what you need to do. We appreciate both of you taking the time to be here, and if there's anything you guys want to say in closing, plug and promote, absolutely anything at all that you might want. Gary, why don't you go ahead?
Well, as always, thank you, Jason. This is the second time I've had the honor of being on your podcast. It's terrific. I love the wrestling community. And, yes, I'm a noted author. Well, at least an author. and my most recent novel is A Mound Over Hell, and it's science fiction baseball dystopia set in 2098. And Jason could even give you a review. And thank you again for having me. And it was great talking to you, Brian.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on. We appreciate it. And Bruce, if you had anything you want to say or plug, go right ahead.
Sure. Follow me on Twitter at Mitchell PW Torch, and There's pwtorch.com, the free site that has podcasts and writing. There's 30 years of my writing available on the Pro Wrestling Torch VIP site, $9.99 a month, and I think we're running a special right now for better. So I do three podcasts a week, and and we'll have a roundtable discussion of the WWE Clash of Champions tonight right after the show. But follow me on Twitter at Mitchell PW Torch.
Gentlemen, thank both of you for being on today. We appreciate it. Best of luck to both of you. Gary, I look forward to the next edition of the book. Looking forward to seeing how things shake out.
Yes,
and
thank you.
Bruce, we definitely look forward to your review of the Clash of Champions tonight. Both of you, welcome back here anytime. We loved having you. And fans, take care of yourselves. Be safe out there. There's a lot of wrestling as we open things back up. So if there's a show near you, go support it as we ease back into things. And we'll be back with you next week. A week from today, we will have Wrestle Club's very own Kiki Starling back as our guest. So make plans to be with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.